The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we provide inspiration and skills to live a happy and fulfilled life using the simple tools of lifestyle, habits, and behaviors. I'm so excited to be joined today by Howard Jacobson. We have so much to talk about habit and lifestyle change and about how and why to reform the healthcare system. Howard Jacobson is co-founder and chief of behavioral science at WellStart Health. He's also the host of the very popular Plant Yourself podcast, and he's collaborated with some of the most courageous and brilliant minds in the research and medical fields. He's contributed to three best-selling books, including the New York Times bestseller Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, written by T. Colin Campbell, who, as many of you know, is the author of The China Study. He's contributed to another book by Dr. Campbell called The Low-Carb Fraud and Dr. Garth Davis's book, Proteinaholic. At WellStart Health, Howard guides clients to adopt and maintain lifestyle and dietary habits in alignment with their health goals and life values. He's been coaching high performers since 2001 and is certified in several renowned methods of coaching. He's earned his MPH and PhD in health studies from Temple University and his BA from Princeton University. His goals include shaking up healthcare, sharing how delicious and joyful a healthy life can be. Howard, we're so honored and delighted to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us. And I think we're having a little bit of technical difficulty, so we'll have Howard join us as we work through some of this. And Howard, your books, podcasts, and your daily work with individual clients have made a difference in so many people's lives, transforming their health and their day-to-day experience. And I find your personal story of the difference lifestyle change has made in your own and in your family's life so profound. It really helps me understand why you're so driven to do the work that you do. Do you mind sharing with our audience a little bit about your own personal journey?
Yeah. So my journey is really one of mistakes and humility, where there's several times in my life I came across this life-changing information, I adopted it, and then I dropped it without even remembering how or when or why. So it began with finding a book by John Robbins called Diet for a New America that for some reason my eye was drawn to. I bought it, I consumed the information, I went whole food plant-based overnight in 1990. And then 6 years later, when my daughter was born, I remember we would, you know, as soon as she could eat solid food, we were taking her out for chicken McNuggets, and I would beg her to eat the cheese and not pull the cheese off the pizza. And it's like everything I had learned was like this dream, you know, where you wake up in the morning and you've had this dream, you're trying to remember it, and by noon, you can't even remember that you had it. It's just like this information, and it kept happening, and it kept happening that I would learn it, I would apply it, and then it would somehow slip away. And so it was only much later that I began to study people who had actually incorporated lifestyle shifts and permanent change in their life that I began to see what I had been doing wrong. And, you know, I was overweight, I was sluggish, I constantly had back pains, I couldn't play with my kids on the floor the way they wanted to. And it was only when I started working on Whole with Dr. Campbell, and that was around December of 2011, that I finally, and I can say finally because now it's been, you know, 7.5 years, so I'm pretty sure this one stuck. I finally understood how to make an initial foray into a lifestyle, into a sustainable habit. And so that's what I was fascinated by. Like, how could I, you mentioned my degrees. I have like huge, fantastic degrees in health studies, in health education. I had access to the best information, to the best people. I had money to buy the right food. And I still was making all the same dumb mistakes that everybody else makes. And so for me to be able to look at myself and say, like, what was missing? What didn't I understand? What was I incapable of? And then to begin to parse that out and to look at people who maybe have had fewer advantages than me, but were able to create lifestyle change and sustain it, to really humble myself and learn from the people who could actually make it happen in their lives, and then start to reverse engineer and apply things in my own life until I finally got the knack.
Wow. And what were the things that you think ultimately helped you get that knack? And that's a pretty big loaded question.
Yeah. So I would say the biggest thing is to create a new orientation towards progress and failure. So in the past, when I would decide, okay, I'm gonna go running. So I'd go and I'd buy a pair of running shoes and I'd go hell bent out of the gate the next morning. I'd try, I want to do 6 miles, I want to do them fast. And I had been a runner. I was on a track team in high school. I was the heaviest sprinter they'd ever had. So I used to go to the meets, and in between, quarter miles and eighth of a mile runs, I would stand between the 60 meter dash and the shot put areas because I was big enough to stop all the other sprinters. So they wouldn't go careening into danger zone. So I could do it, and then I'd come home and I would feel terrible. I'd have my calves would be on fire the next day. I'd have something sprained, and the shoes would sit in the back of the closet, and I would not do it again for 6 months. And so I had this attitude, progress meant I had to go all out. I had to be as good as I was when I first started, or as good as I ever was. And that if I failed, that meant it was over. And so I see this with so many people. They'll go on a diet, and then one day they'll give in and they'll binge. They'll have 2 beers and 4 slices of pizza, or they'll be at the office and someone will be coming around with a plate of Krispy Kremes, and they've been really, really good. But now, I'll just have a bite, and then they have 2, and then they're like, oh, well, that didn't work. And so what I see people do, and what I've learned to do, is understand that slip-ups, that screw-ups, that failure is part of being human. And all it means is I've got information that I can apply next time. So before, I used to think that, I fell off the wagon. And if you think about that metaphor, the wagon is still going, right? I'm on my butt. I got grass and dust and blood in my mouth, and the wagon is going up the hill, and I can't catch it anymore. I'm done. I've fallen off the wagon. Whereas really, it's a path. And all I've done is taken one step off the path. And how do I know it's one step? Because it only takes one step to get back on the path. So that was the biggest thing, that all those mistakes and false starts and screw-ups that I would make along the way simply turned into data to analyze and do something differently next time, as opposed to confirmation that I couldn't have this or I couldn't be this.
No, and that is such a good point. I think that resonates with so many people. As you were saying this, I was thinking of, everyone that is so motivated at the start of the year, say after Christmas, to get on a better path with exercise and diet. And I think a lot of people have New Year's resolutions, do really well for several weeks. And, invariably, as the year goes on, they get off their plan and have so much trouble getting back on. And to your point, that really is human. And I love that perspective of saying, expect that as just part of how we're made. It's going to happen, factor it in, and just get right back on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great. So as you are coaching your clients in that whole process of how to get back on, there's a lot of discouragement that happens when people feel that, I was doing so well, then I ate the Krispy Kreme. What are ways that you keep your clients motivated and help them get back on? Mm-hmm.
So one thing I absolutely refuse to do is motivate my clients.
Interesting. And why is that?
Well, because motivation is like pumping up the air in a bicycle tire that has a leak. So just to give you a little background. So the medical profession, as you probably know, is used to sort of command and control, right? Patient comes in and we tell them what to do, right? We give them a pill and we give them a script and we send them away, and we expect them to comply. Now, you're a member of ACLM.
Yes.
Right? So American College of Lifestyle Medicine. You can't prescribe lifestyle in the same way. People have to comply. And so doctors, lifestyle medicine doctors and others began to understand that we needed to learn something called motivational interviewing to connect what we want people to do with their goals to make it more likely that they're going to do it. So people absolutely need to be motivated to begin the journey. The trouble is that motivation naturally wanes. It goes up, it goes down. Some days you're really excited. Usually at the beginning, you're really excited. And then on some other day, you couldn't be bothered to get out of bed. You hit the snooze button five times and you go, oh, well, I guess I'm not motivated anymore. And so when people aren't motivated, they stop. But you know what? Almost everybody I know wakes up in the morning some days and is not motivated to go to work. And I don't know if that's ever happened to you. You have a fantastic job, like helping people like I do. But do you know what I mean? Like some days you're like, oh, I don't want to do it today.
Oh, I think we all have days like that, if we're honest.
Yeah, or I don't really want to cook for my kids and drive them to ballet today, right? But we do it anyway. So the idea that we need motivation in order to live a healthy lifestyle becomes in itself a stumbling block, because the minute motivation's gone, we go, oh, well, I guess that's not for me. As opposed to you're a professional, you have an identity. I have an identity as a parent. And that identity means that whether I'm motivated or not, I get up and I do it. And I don't spend time debating in my head as to whether I should or not. So that's the orientation we teach people to take. You make this a decision, you turn it into a rule, you turn it into a standard for yourself, and you just do it. And so now it becomes a matter of skill building so that you can do it when you're tired. You can do it when you're hungry. You can do it when there's a lot of social pressure from your family or coworkers. And these are all skills that we build as opposed to character traits that we either have or don't have.
But to get to the point where you want to make a healthy lifestyle your identity, or you want to call yourself, say, a runner or an athlete, to get to that point, there's got to be a reason a person wants to do it, right? Like that could be to feel healthier. It could be to live long enough to see grandchildren.
Yes, so absolutely. But the point is that people have their own motivations. So a sailor can't make the wind blow, but a better sailor gets farther on the wind than another one. So as health coaches, we are sailors. We can't make the wind blow for our clients, right? And so when we try to sort of, hey, but what about this? But what about that? We're actually stealing their autonomy by imposing our own motivations on them. So part of coaching is absolutely assessing and uncovering why somebody wants to do that. And there's lots of great techniques. So one thing that I will do with my coaching clients is they look at where they are today, and then we have them look at, well, let's look at the future in 20 years if you make this change. And so what people will tend to do then is compare that to today. Oh, well, now I'm 30 pounds overweight. I'm pre-diabetic. If I make these changes, I'll drop the weight. I'll feel better. I won't be on meds. I'll get off my metformin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you also want to take them 20 years into the future if they fail. What if you don't make this change? Then what does your 20-year anniversary look like? All right, I'm 75 pounds overweight. I'm on multiple meds. I've got comorbidities. I've got metabolic syndrome. I might have an amputation, I have neuropathy, I'm going blind in one eye. And you help them compare the ideal with the nightmare. And so that usually is enough motivation to get someone started. But the point is, when you wake up in the morning and you're tired, or when you walk past, Cinnabon in the airport, and you smell that the motivation of the moment can outweigh those motivations. It's just a different part of the brain. Or when we're stressed out, right? So most people make bad decisions when they're under a lot of stress. That's because a different part of the brain is commanding the decision process. So we want to get people to the point where, so I've got this initial motivation. Now I'm going to apply that motivation to learn skills. Skills are much more persistent and reliable than motivation. If I could brush my teeth today, I can brush my teeth tomorrow, regardless of how badly I want to brush my teeth if I'm already laying in bed. And we also want to apply that motivation to create prompts in our environment that make the default thing the easier thing to do.
Right, which I think is so important. And, you know, as I'm listening to you, Howard, I'm really thinking about how what you're saying is so similar to parenting, right? We're trying to get our kids to have internal motivation to, you know, have the skills and want to have the skills to be independent in life, because we know as parents, we can't always be there to, you know, coach, guide, redirect. But I think once the child has that motivation from within, then they will go on to want to learn the skills and then sustain whatever path that they want to be on. And I think that point between external versus that internal motivation, you're right. You do almost transfer responsibility onto yourself if you're the one motivating, as opposed to when that motivation comes from within.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is what's also, I think you touched on another really critical part about successful and sustained changes. In bringing up the point about how you want to make the path of least resistance, the change that you want to adopt, like removing obstacles towards the things you want to do and increasing obstacles with the habits that you want to break. Because, you know, in some ways, humans are really complicated creatures. In other ways, we're just so simple. And one small little obstacle in our automatic primitive brain just, you know, uses that as a reason to not do something. Like, you know, let's say if we have to take an extra 2 steps to get something healthy versus 1 step to get junk food, well, that second step is enough to get our primitive brain to not want to do it subconsciously.
Right. And here, you know, you know, like, you ever see a Roomba?
No, I haven't.
Those discs, those vacuum cleaner discs that go around on the floor all by themselves. And they just, you know, like programmed, and they like, you're just trying to pick up dirt. And so when they hit a wall, they then turn around. If they hit a piece of furniture, they, you know, a leg, they pull a chair, they go around it.
I'm going to still vacuum the old fashioned way.
Yeah, I do too. I don't know why. I heard a terrible story about someone who had a puppy that did his business in the house, and the Roomba essentially turned the whole place into an unholy mess. But like, I would never use one of those things. But like, the Roomba doesn't care about obstacles because it has a positive mission, right? It's got an algorithm that's been programmed in it. And so I think I agree with you completely about the importance of environment. And at the same time, if we rely too heavily on environment and we're trying to curate our environment so that there's no resistance to the good and lots of resistance to the bad, we're making ourselves very fragile to things that ultimately aren't in our control. So for me, the ultimate in developing a path of no resistance, of least resistance, is to embrace a positive identity. So for like, if my goal here is to lose 30 pounds and reverse my diabetes, those are admirable and they're both negative, meaning they're things I'm trying to avoid or get away from. So once I've done it, once I've lost my 35 pounds, what am I going to do? I'm probably going to go celebrate by eating the same food that put the 35 pounds on in the first place. Or what's the first thing I'm going to do when I get my A1C to below pre-diabetic levels? I'm going to celebrate with the very foods that I ate to get me to be pre-diabetic or diabetic in the first place. So as long as we're running away from something, as long as I'm being chased, as soon as the person chasing me slows down, I slow down. As soon as I get far enough away, I stop, bend over double, and try to catch my breath. Whereas if I'm chasing something positive, something that I want, whether it's I want to be able to climb mountains in my 80s and go on these great vacations, whether it's, in my case, I want to become an athlete and improve my performance every single year in my 50s so that at age 55, I'm faster than I was at 52. And now, all of a sudden, the thought of eating some crap, it simply isn't. It's like my Roomba is now programmed to avoid that because I know I'm eating for the purpose of this athletic performance, for the purpose of this identity. So that's why I think it's so important, because like everything else, it feels like I'm climbing a mountain. I got to get motivated. Oh, look at how big the mountain is. I really need motivation to do it. I need self-efficacy. I need to believe that I could get to the top of the mountain. I need to develop strategies and I have to read the China study. I have to go watch Forks Over Knives. I have to find a dietitian. I have to find a community. I have to learn how to cook. I have to then develop the tactics and the ability to do all those things. I have to develop follow through so that I keep doing them until they're second nature. It's still all uphill. Once you would develop an identity and say, this is who I am. I'm an athlete. I am a responsible grandparent. I am a business executive. I am an effective public health physician. And now everything is about that. That's downhill. Now I'm just coasting. And all the habits that I had to work so hard to get are now being fueled by the gravitational pull of this thing I want, as opposed to these negative outcomes I've been running away from.
And what I love about what you just said is that there's so much power to having a vision of where you want to be. You know, I think a lot of times we work really hard, but we are not really necessarily envisioning where we're going. And to start off with that as an identity really does help you through the ups and downs. I think that's a really powerful way of viewing, you know, any health goal or truly any goal in life in general.
Yeah, I mean, the point of life is not to be healthy. The point of life is to live life, and health is, you know, the major contributor to that. But let's keep our eye on what we know really gets the human heart excited, which is experiences and contribution.
Yeah. And now I know you work a lot one-on-one with a lot of people, but you've also started WellStart Health. How did that come about, and how did you decide how you were going to structure that program?
So Josh Lajani and I were doing something called the Big Change Program, which was just sort of working with groups of individuals. And we began to discover as we went through it, certain things work better than others, certain types of coaching. We found that, to our surprise, people were doing better in community with groups and less individual attention than they were with one-on-one. That somehow the group energy had its own generative power that was more powerful even than working with Josh, who's a force of nature, or me with all my background in behavior change. That just being part of a supportive community, of feeling like, okay, here's a new normal. Here's people that can pick me up when I'm down. There's a no judgment zone. We quickly realized that community was the key to helping people. And so a lot of these people live in, you know, towns, communities where no one else is doing this. There's not a plant-based doctor or a health food store within 200 miles or anyone else who's eating a healthy diet. And so they needed this online community, and they become really, really close friends. We just had a reunion of 12 of them, plus me and Josh, at PlantStock this past weekend. And we'd never met each other before, but instant family. So then when I talked to Olivia Kelly, who had already founded WellStart Health, and we were looking for a platform, a digital platform, to be able to do more things, and she was looking for the cutting edge behavioral model to incorporate, we just started talking and figured, well, this is, you know, a match made in heaven. And also, Olivia's like good at like executive stuff, like follow through and making decisions, and has a real background in the healthcare system. So beyond just plant-based, but how insurance works, how third-party administration works, how benefits work. So she had this vision of bringing what we do to a larger, non-plant-based audience. And so Josh and I said, well, this is a way to grow this thing far beyond what we could do on our own. So that's kind of how it came about. So there's individual support. There's a lot of asynchronous communication, which, fancy word in the online learning space where we just send them stuff and they read it whenever they want or watch the videos whenever they want. And there's a real strong cohort component of getting people to know each other, to like each other, to support each other, and to feel like, you know, Josh talks about, do you know Josh Lajani?
I do not know Josh.
So he's got a great story, and but part of it, you know, transformation from 420 pounds to the cover of Runner's World in 4 years.
Wow, that is a great story.
And the trigger for him was he's a huge football fan, and his team is the New Orleans Saints. And after years of them being terrible, they won the Super Bowl. And he really took that to heart, and he read the coach's memoir about the season, and he started treating himself like a member of the team. And he would go around asking himself, "Would this, the way I'm behaving now, would that make coach proud? Is this contributing to the team?" Because he'd been a football player in high school and college. And he's big guy, so he was on the line. He never did the glamorous glory stuff. He just blocked so the quarterback could throw, so the running back could run. And so he had a very big sense of, I have to contribute in my way for the team to be successful. And so we've incorporated that into our programs where everybody feels like, it's like a tug of war, and nobody will notice if you take your hands off the rope because everyone's pulling, but you'll know. And so you feel a responsibility. Most of us feel more responsibility towards others than we do towards ourselves. And so we cultivate that. Everyone who goes through our program has become an ambassador and is going to go spread the word. There's absolutely nothing that we have in terms of intellectual property that's proprietary. The only thing we charge for is things that we have to pay and get paid for, like the platform and our time. But you know, all of our insights and intellectual property and methodology is just freely available because we're just trying to, you know, help the movement with our, you know, keeping our own hands on the tug of war rope.
Yeah, and for our audience, just as a little background about the WellStart Health program. So it's a 12-week program and has 5 core elements: mindfulness, movement, optimal diet, resilience, and social support. And the results that you've seen from that program are actually pretty impressive and dramatic. Can you tell us more about some of those results from the people who participated?
Yeah, so we have actually a pretty bold guarantee to employers, which is you take your employees, put them through the program, and if they participate, and we have standards for what that looks like. So this is what we know, and this is what you know, and what every lifestyle doc knows. If people do the stuff, then like gravity, like physics, it's predictable that they're going to get better. This isn't like, well, let's really hope that if people eat better, that they're going to improve their numbers. So we just, you know, we have this unfair advantage that we know that this stuff really works. So if people go through the program and they participate and they don't improve to the point that we've agreed upon, whatever it is for that individual, they get to go through again for free. And if the second time they don't get the improvement, we will refund 75% of the money. So
that's pretty bold. That's putting money where your mouth is.
Yeah. So the only thing is that, you know, they have to participate. They have to go, they watch the videos, they have to show up, join with a forum, text back and forth with their coaches. And we know when people do that, then they begin to make these changes. And we know when people begin to make these changes, two things happen. One is the biology begins to right itself and they start feeling better. So they become more and more committed over time.
Right.
So we know when people participate that they get better. So we've seen people, I just got a text from someone today, he just sent me his calcium score, you know, his cardiologist to zeros across the board. I haven't asked him like, is this the first one he's done or is this the post and is there a pre in which it was worse? But we have people reversing their diabetes, losing 150 pounds. The proudest ones for me are people who say something like, I finally got off my antidepressants after 20 years, which is pretty unheard of.
Right.
And we don't even deal, like that's not one of the things we deal with. We're not psychologists. We're not therapists. We don't even talk about depression. Right. But right. It turns out that depression is very often a symptom or result of eating badly, not moving, and not having a family and a community that you feel part of. And so when we take care of that, you know, lower level stuff, the mind gets to write itself.
I think that's one of the most gratifying things about what we do. I mean, most of us who promote lifestyle-based practice or lifestyle-based medicine, first of all, have personally experienced the benefit in our own lives, which makes us feel so strongly about promoting it for others. And it's these success stories, you know, it's seeing people get off of medication, feel better, live the type of life they didn't live before or didn't even know they could live, that make this so compelling.
Yeah. And then we, you know, and then we hear stories. So like Josh talks about this all the time, that when he discovered X, like this newfangled way of eating, or that running helps you lose weight, what goes through our mind when we prove this stuff to ourselves is, what else is true that I didn't think was true? Or what else is out there that I didn't even know about? So we hear, and so, you know, we have a 12-week program, but we also have maintenance. So people can stay on for as long as they want. So we have a lot of people who've been with us for a couple of years now, and they just, you know, they show up and they're actually like doing more work than benefiting. They're coming now to coach others and to be helpful, just to be part of this community. But this, you know, and we hear from them, oh, I got a new job. I didn't like my old job anymore. Like their standards go up. You know, somebody said, you know what, I'm getting a divorce. Like, I don't want to market that, join our program and get a divorce. But the person was ecstatic. Like, I've been living with this for years and it wasn't right for me. And now I feel like I'm worth more.
Like you said, not exactly how you want to market, but your point's well made. And the beautiful thing about it is that this is not like a fad, if you will. I mean, there's so much science really explaining how and why, you know, exercise or plant-based foods are causing these changes in people's lives. And you in particular, I mean, you've had the honor to work with probably one of the most brilliant minds with Dr. Campbell. And mm-hmm. I think the China study for a lot of people has been really a turning point in their life. So I have to ask you, what was it like working with him?
Oh, it was amazing. I remember I was living in South Africa with my family at the time. So it was actually quite hard from a technical standpoint. We couldn't meet. We were doing everything by email. The phone connections were terrible. Skype wasn't really available because of the low bandwidth of the region where I was living. So for a lot of it, it was just, we would do emails back and forth. And one of the things that struck me from the very beginning was how interested he was, not just in my ability to craft structure and sentence, but how he wanted, like, what do you think of this idea? And what about this? Do you think this fit? And he was like, he was treating me like I knew something. And, you know, for a while, I just, you're Colin Campbell. Why would you ask me? But after a while, I started to see myself as someone who had value to offer. And there were some areas of science where I challenged him. I said, but look at this and look at this. And he would say, great, send that to me. Let me read it. So I got to see not only someone who has really strong opinions, but someone who has absolutely zero attachment to any of them. I mean, you know, that's his story, right? Is he was a protein researcher dedicated to improving the efficiency of livestock production. And he changed when he saw evidence. And so he hasn't stopped doing that. I said, here's a study that seems to show that certain type of cattle management could reduce greenhouse gases. He says, oh, cool, show it to me. Let me see that. And so no matter what it was, he was a scientist and he was going to read it with an open mind and just looking for truth. He had no interest in doctrine or dogma. And that was something I had never experienced close up before. And it made a huge impact on me.
Yeah, you know, that ability to really be open to seeing things differently, I think is what spurs the creativity that leads to the type of breakthrough information that he's been able to contribute to the whole field of understanding plant-based diets.
Yeah. When you read the China study and you see his trajectory, you can easily put it down to chance, right? Like, oh, he happened to be working in the Philippines. He happened to have done these assays on Aspergillus and the mold, the aflatoxin molds in peanuts. And he happened to have this conversation, and he happened to stumble upon this study from India in 1972 about protein in mice. And it's like the way he describes it, it was like he's sort of this, you know, country bumpkin stumbling upon. But the truth is, we, you know, there's a lot of interesting research on luck, on what makes people lucky. And it turns out that the thing that makes people lucky is openness, is a willingness to look around and notice things that other people don't notice. And like that just epitomizes T. Colin Campbell. He's curious, he's open-minded, and he is not in the least bit defensive about science and about truth. He gets very upset when other people play fast and loose with it. Right? He doesn't like people to be manipulated by marketing that looks to that pretends to be science. But in terms of if you show him a study and say, here, I think this contradicts you, he will read it with great eagerness because he wants to know where and how and if he's wrong.
Right. And I think that ultimately is how things advance. It's seeing things in a, you know, that maybe other people had dismissed before, but then seeing in a whole different light or seeing it differently. And going down that path. And I think that's part of the brilliance, you know, of what he's been able to contribute.
Yeah. It's a little ironic, but, you know, three of the greatest minds in our field, Colin, Caldwell Esselstyn, and Neil Barnard, all grew up on dairy farms. So I'm kind of, you know, there's something about the practicality of farming, I think, that grounds you as a researcher.
So no, it's interesting. You live on a farm, don't you?
We moved to, well, let's say farmlet. Mm-hmm. We moved to a piece of land that we could grow things on.
Yeah, it's we own a farm as well, so it is kind of interesting. It's kind of a funny how that seems to be a very common theme.
Yeah, well, there's nothing like a piece of land to humble you about your theories.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
Oh, like I have this great theory and it didn't grow anything.
Yeah.
You know.
And this is, you know, for Tina is a member of our team. I promised her I would ask you this. So you do Russian martial arts, is that right?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So I promised her I'd ask you about that. What exactly do you do?
Basically I get hit in the face a lot by people stronger and faster than younger than me.
Sounds like a very fun experience.
It is. I mean, I'm being a little bit facetious, but it does involve a lot of physical pain and discomfort. And you know, people are good enough at it that it doesn't feel dangerous. Like I've rarely been injured doing it, but it's just like everything else that, like, when I started doing it, I was terrified of touch. Of like being hit by people, like, you know, and most of us go through life with more or less of a bubble of comfort around us. And we're terrified of having that bubble pop because we don't know what it would be like. What would it be like if I was in a 52 degree and rainy environment instead of 72 degrees and climate controlled? And so when I started doing it, and like people were like, we're literally like sort of hitting me in the face and doing arm bars and causing, you know, pain where I had to tap out. To realize that, oh, my body is kind of meant for this. Like, I can not only withstand it, but now when I go through life, I have a lot less stress because I know that if things happen, I can roll with them. And so I find that actually, it goes a long way with like running or walking around, like, okay, so now this is what it's like to run up this hill with my heart racing and my chest pounding and out of breath. It was terrible, and it wasn't that bad. Or I have this craving. I feel like I have to eat. I have to go to the back of the cabinet and find the chocolate chips and eat them all right now. And I'm not going to do it. And I'm used to discomfort. And I'm used to being in situations that feel suboptimal in the moment. And the benefits that I get from being strong, from not giving in, from tolerating these suboptimal experiences produce joy. Right, that I found that happiness and joy are not the same thing. Happiness is like, oh, this is great in the moment. And joy is the feeling of my soul growing stronger and me becoming who I am even more. And so it's, we don't get that through positive experiences. We get that through hardship, through challenge, through difficulty. And so Sistema, my Russian martial art, exemplifies every time I go there, I know there's going to be something unpleasant that I'm going to have to deal with.
That is such an interesting perspective, but you're absolutely right. It's kind of analogous to what doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
Yep.
And Howard, before we go, I just want to, certainly summarize and share some of what you've shared with us for our listeners. And I really just, keep thinking back to having that identity. I just really think that's such an interesting perspective. It's so different than I think the starting point a lot of people have when they embark on making any type of change in their life. Are there other things that you would want, say, like big take homes for our listeners?
Say one other thing is that we live in a society in which we exercise so that we can eat, right? So you see this, at the finish line of races, where these people who are in great shape, who have run much faster than me, as soon as they finish, they will head over to the Chick-fil-A tent and reward themselves, or they'll go to the M&Ms and peanut butter jelly sandwiches and stuff their faces because, by golly, I just earned, this food. And so all of us, we tend to think of, I just went on the treadmill for two Snickers bars worth of a run. And again, this is to go along with this idea of an identity of an athlete. Instead of moving so that we can eat, which is the same as like, I'm going to drive my car so I get to go to the gas station and fill up. The way we think about cars is I'm going to fill up so I can go on this great trip. So part of the identity, become an athlete so that you're eating, is in order to fuel your life, as opposed to I'm going to do my 10,000 steps so that I can enjoy these junky foods.
Yeah. And, it kind of reminds me of the great point you made earlier about instead of kind of like a negative motivator of having like something positive to work for. And it's really just very positive to always have that good fuel in your body, because to your point, once you accomplish X or Y, viewing something as a reward can undo all that great work.
Yeah. And we're lucky enough to live in a time where it feels to me like human life on the planet is in the balance. There's enough challenges that we can, all of us can pick the one we want, whether it's animal welfare, human health, conflict and peace, environmental issues. Like, we have such a smorgasbord of things that need love and attention. If that becomes our ultimate identity, like, I want to leave this world a better place, then everything we do, we can then say, well, is this going to fuel that or is it going to detract from it? Is this piece of cake that I could have right now is going to give me 30 seconds of jollies? Is it going to allow me to live this joyful life of service, contribution, compassion, and love? And, when you look at it that way, there's really no comparison.
Well, I think from all the work that you've already done, I think, we can all say that you've made your contribution to leave this planet a better place. And I thank you for all the work you do every day in helping other people live healthier lives and just contributing to just the body of science and knowledge that we have about not just what to do, but really effective ways to get on the right path to continue doing them. So thank you for all that work.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And I have to say, I do it for totally selfish reasons.
Keeps you young. Well, thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate your time and great conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Sharon. It was great talking to you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.